You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio, 96.5 FM, and also streaming live at WSLR.org. My name is Emily, and my guest today is veteran scientific ufologist Kathleen Marsden, who is the co-author of the book Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Are you having nice weather up there?
Well, today it appears to be fairly nice but cold. We have a clear blue sky, but we still have a lot of snow on the ground.
Well, I'm in Florida, so we don't.
Oh.
Kathleen, you have written a very, very interesting book. I read it. You co-wrote it with Stanton Friedman.
Yes, I did.
You have a really interesting perspective on the Betty and Barney Hill experience. You're actually Betty's niece.
Yes, I am.
How old were you when Betty and Barney had their experience?
I was 13 years old when, on September 20th, 1961, when Betty phoned my mother to report that she and my uncle had had a close encounter with a UFO in New Hampshire's White Mountains the previous evening. And that was a huge surprise to me because my family had no interest in UFOs. I'd really never heard any discussion about the topic before. So it was quite an eye-opener.
Do you remember what was your first reaction to it?
Well, I told my mother that I didn't think that it was flying saucers were real. I had learned in school that probably the other planets weren't inhabited and that probably Earth was the only place where life existed. And, you know, so I was very, very surprised to think that some advanced technological civilization could possibly be visiting Earth.
And what was your mother's reaction? Did she think that Betty was out of her mind?
Oh, absolutely not. She knew Betty and Barney were respectable, highly stable people who were well-respected and well-liked in the community. Betty was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office. There was no question about their sanity or their honesty. They were church-going people. And my mother believed what Betty told her. In fact, in 1957, I found out on September 20th, 1961, my mother had actually had a UFO sighting herself. And this was on a Friday night. She was going grocery shopping, driving through rural New Hampshire, and hovering over a field, she saw what appeared to be a huge blimp-like structure, only it obviously wasn't a blimp. She stopped at a neighbor's house, went in, and the neighbors came out and also observed this unidentified flying object, and a number of smaller craft entered it. It rose vertically and disappeared at a very rapid rate.
And did she only tell you this after?
Yes, I had never heard about it until September 20th, 1961, although it happened in 1957. So that day was a huge eye-opener for me.
Let's talk a bit about the actual abduction. How did it occur for Betty and Barney?
Well, I want to say first that Betty and Barney were not aware that they had been abducted until 1964. This event happened in 1961. They had full conscious memory of having a close encounter with a large, silent, hovering craft.
Mm-hmm.
It hovered 80 to 100 feet above their vehicle. Barney had full conscious memory of getting out of that vehicle and observing figures on board the craft, and became very frightened that he was going to be captured. It was obvious to him that they were in a craft that we didn't have on this planet and that they were not from this planet. He rapidly returned to the vehicle, although he was incapable of moving for a while, and told Betty that he thought that they were going to be captured. He was very frantic in a hysterical state at this point from fear. Got into the car and started racing down U.S. Highway Route 3 as the craft hovered above his vehicle, and Betty and Barney heard these a series of beeping, code-like beeping or buzzing sounds that seemed to bounce off the trunk of their car. It caused a vibration to pass through the car and their bodies, and they started to feel very sleepy at that point. Now, about 35 miles down the road, they suddenly became fully conscious again. They did recall seeing or observing a large fiery orb in the road that was silhouetted against a stand of trees. They did recall a second series of these beeping or buzzing sounds, and they returned home. They drove home after that, and when they arrived home, things did not seem right. They were missing time. They were missing about 2 hours, even allowing for 3 observational stops they made to observe this craft at very close range. Betty's dress was torn. There was a 1-inch tear on one side of the top of her dress and a 2-inch tear on the other side. The lining was torn. The hem was torn down. This doesn't happen on a simple ride through the mountains returning home from a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
There was debris on Barney's pants. The tops of his shoes were deeply scraped. He couldn't wear them for anything but yard work after that. And Barney was a meticulous dresser. He wasn't the type to be sloppy at all in his dress. He was wearing a brown suit that night and his best dress suit shoes. Their watches that had been operating perfectly fine the night before were broken. They never worked again. There were 12 to 18 highly polished circular spots on the trunk of their car that responded when a compass was placed over them. They had become magnetic, and the compass needle would spin and spin. So there were all of these mysterious things, all of this physical evidence to go along with this period of missing time. And what they found out in 1964, when they went to a very famous psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon, after Barney had been suffering from a number of physiological ailments, is that they had actually been abducted during this period of missing time, taken on board a craft, and subjected to a number of physical experiments and examinations.
Now, why did it take them 3 years to look into it more deeply?
Well, first, almost immediately, they were looking for a hypnotist. Betty, I believe it was on September 26, 1961, wrote to NICAP, National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena, and reported the UFO sighting and also mentioned that Barney had developed a mental block for what had happened and they were considering hypnosis. They spoke to a number of hypnotists in the interim, and they were advised not to undergo hypnosis right away, that perhaps over time they would start to remember some of the things that they had forgotten. And in fact, they did start to remember those things. So when they went to Dr. Simon, they were not completely amnesic for that period of time. Barney did start to see a psychiatrist because he had developed a bleeding ulcer, high blood pressure, and anxiety, sleeplessness, and these things were not responding to traditional medical treatments. So I thought there had to be an emotional basis for what was going on here. And the psychiatrist had thought, actually, that Barney had made a very good adjustment to his life in New Hampshire. He was very active in the civil rights movement. He was achieving a great deal of recognition in the state for his activism, and had a very happy life with Betty. And they were sort of trying to delve deeper into what might be causing these problems. And, you know, now we know that it might have just been H. pylori bacteria, along with a few other issues that he might have had. But one day, Betty and Barney had gone to the White Mountains to try to jog their memories again about what happened during that period of missing time. They did that frequently. And so Barney mentioned to his psychiatrist, Dr. Duncan Stevens, that they had gone on this trip to the White Mountains and told him about this UFO experience. And Dr. Stevens thought this might be significant. He didn't do hypnosis himself, but he referred Betty and Barney to a renowned psychiatrist in Boston, Dr. Benjamin Simon. He was a psychiatrist and a neurologist. He had set up the Mason General Hospital psychiatric unit during World War II. It was a 3,000-bed unit. And he had a great deal of success in treating returning veterans from the war who were suffering from what we then called shell shock. Mm-hmm. And a movie, Let There Be Light, was actually made about his work because he had so much success, whereas traditional psychotherapy or even hypnotherapy with other doctors had not been as successful. Dr. Simon had a special technique for getting to the truth, for getting down to that nitty-gritty of what happened that set off that period of amnesia in these veterans. So he was perfect for Betty and Barney. And they were referred to him. They went for a consultation in December of 1963 and began therapy in January of 1964. They were seen separately. One waited in a soundproof room with very loud classical music playing, while the other one was undergoing hypnotherapy and traditional therapy with Dr. Simon. And Dr. Simon imposed amnesia at the end of each session so that not only could Betty and Barney not remember what they had told Dr. Simon under regression, but they couldn't discuss it with each other. So there was no possibility of contamination from one to the other. And I think that this was very significant in my study of the case.
How many sessions did they actually go for with him? Was it over a very long period of time?
Yes, it was over a six-month period of time.
And it seems, I've heard online, on YouTube actually, I found there were some of the recordings of the actual hypnosis sessions. And I noticed in it that it was just a short segment. Barney seemed much calmer and more almost flat as he relayed the stuff. And Betty was very, very agitated and obviously very traumatized. Was that true of how they both dealt with the situation?
Not necessarily so. I released selected recordings to Linda Moulton Howe after my book was released. And I believe that those are the recordings that you heard on YouTube.
Yeah.
When I lecture, I also play selected recordings for the audience. There were times when Barney was very traumatized. For example, when he was standing in the field, as this craft was hovering maybe 50 to 80 feet away from him, and he was observing through his binoculars this group of figures who he felt were ready to carry out a plan and who reminded him of Nazi military officers. And I'm not saying that they looked like Nazi officers. They didn't. It was their precision of movement and the feeling he had that they were willing and able and intended to carry out a plan to capture him. He was getting that feeling from them because one remained at the window and the others moved to a panel on the back of the wall on this corridor that circled around this pancake or disc-shaped craft with a double row of windows. So when this happened, when they moved to that panel, small, almost like fin-like structures with a red light on each end telescoped out of the side of the craft, and something began to drop out of the bottom of the craft. And that leader who stood at the window staring down at Barney with these very, very frightening eyes was giving him the telepathic message that he needed to stay there and just keep looking. Stay there and just keep looking. Barney had a pistol in his pocket. He wanted to go to the for the pistol. He wanted to shoot it down. And he was very upset on the first hypnosis tape that you heard. Very traumatized. So
now,
if you listen to the excerpt from the first hypnosis, you'll hear all of that emotion in Barney. As time went on through these hypnosis sessions where Dr. Simon would go through the entire scenario over and over again, we see that there was a cathartic effect after that initial reaction, that tremendous release of emotion. And Barney was able to rationally describe what he saw. And was able to, I guess, emotionally handle that a lot better and explain it to Dr. Simon, you know, as if it were something that he was observing at that point but was detached emotionally from it. That's because he had worked through that trauma. So both Betty and Barney had many periods of trauma throughout the hypnosis. But then they also had the explanations of what had happened to them, maybe in a little more detail, where they were no longer traumatized.
When he described them as being Nazi-like people, so they weren't the, you know, little green men or even the very common, you know, the big sort of bug-eyed creatures that people seem to describe a lot. So they were...
Yes, they were.
...human-looking.
They were not little green men. They were, they had larger heads than we have.
Mm-hmm.
They had those very large wraparound eyes with a vertical pupil. They did have, they were very much like the stereotypic image we think of aliens. And if you pick up my book, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, there are several artists' paintings in the book where you'll be able to actually see what Betty and Barney described to different artists about what their captors looked like. And also I've written a chapter on the physical description of them as well. So actually, yes, they did have that gray skin. They did have those large eyes. There were no visible earlobes. They were very much like the stereotypes that we think of. The crew, consisting of the leader and the examiner, and possibly some of the crew, were 4.5 to 5 feet tall. There was also at least one who was much more like that little tiny gray, that 3.5 foot tall gray that we think of. His head was much larger in proportion to his body. So, they were the first, actually, to describe those.
That was going to be my next question. This is, I think, one of the most famous and probably most well-documented abduction cases. Is it the first documented case, or were there others going on around that time or prior to that?
It is the first documented case. Subsequently, we heard about the Antonio Vias Boas case in South America, down in Brazil. But that information wasn't released until many years later, and it had actually occurred back in the late 50s. But so we didn't know about it at that time, and it came out after Betty and Barney's information came out in 1965 and 1966.
When they went through this experience, were there other reports on that night or of that time of people seeing an object?
Yes. Betty and Barney's case was always to remain confidential. They never wanted the public to know about this. But through a violation of confidentiality, a newspaper reporter from Boston got wind of the story and actually ended up publishing 5 articles in a Boston newspaper. And in those articles, he spoke about other people, other witnesses that night. Also, I have newspaper articles from way back. Unfortunately, there's not a date on them. I found them in Betty's files. And they spoke about people who had actually had UFOs hovering over their vehicles in that same area. And in another case, I was visiting Betty one day at her home. This was probably in the late 1990s or early around 2000, 2001, and she was on the telephone when I arrived with a man who was telling her that he had also seen that craft on that particular night. He was a truck driver. He had been driving through the White Mountains, and he was buzzed by this craft. I wanted her to write his name down for me, to give me his telephone number, his information, because I wanted to interview him, so just to have this on record. And I was very upset when she didn't do that for me. And I said, why didn't you get his name? Why didn't you write down his information for me? And she said, no amount of evidence, no amount of eyewitness testimony is going to convince a skeptic that this happened. So she had developed that attitude at that point, that it was completely useless to obtain any other eyewitness testimony or to do any more research into this case. I disagreed, and that's why I continued my research and why I wrote this book, and I did uncover a great deal of information that the public had never heard about.
Now, it sometimes can be very, very hard, even if you're consciously aware of an incident happening. Certainly over the years, as you retell the tale, other events are going to get muddled in and you might get details muddled up. Did you find when you were doing your research and reviewing all Betty's information that that did happen for her? That maybe when she was recounting a tale, that the story, 10 years later, that it was mixed up with other incidents?
What I can tell you is that I had all of Betty's files dating back to 1961 when she made her confidential report. I had all of the scientific reports and all of the letters that she wrote to and received from the scientists who investigated this case. In 1996, she turned the hypnosis tapes over to me, and after listening to them many times, I transcribed them, and then I dissected sentence for sentence these transcripts and lined her statements up against Barney's to do a comparative analysis. I wanted to know for myself if this really happened or if this was just two people repeating a fantasy. So I had all of the accurate information. I compared that to Betty's later statements because I played devil's advocate and interviewed her on tape-recorded interviews for many years. We were very close, and I spent quite a lot of time with her late in her life. And late in her life, she did confuse events. For example, when the craft was hovering over her car and there were these beeping and buzzing sounds bouncing off the trunk, she was terrified. You can hear her crying on the hypnosis tape. She was very upset. Yet, late in life, she claimed she rolled down the window, waved, and yelled, "Hi, boys!" You know, so that was very different from what actually happened. And I don't know if it was bravado on her part or if she had retold the story so many times that she wanted to add some humor. I really can't account for her motivation for changing the story that way. But we do know that human memory is malleable, and over time it can change. So that's completely normal as well.
Right, and perhaps even her joking about it years later could be because the incident was less traumatic. She'd been through it so many times, over it so many times, when it's less disturbing to recount. I suppose also you can add different sort of slants on it. You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio 96.5 FM. We're also streaming live at WSLR.org. My guest today is Kathleen Marden, who is the co-author of the book Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Kathleen, we haven't talked much about Barney. He died, unfortunately, quite young. How long after the incident did he die?
The incident occurred in 1961, and Barney died in February of 1969.
And do you think he ever fully recovered from what he'd been through?
I don't think he did. He did recover from his bleeding ulcers. He did begin to feel better. He was very proactive. The governor of New Hampshire even appointed him to sit on the state advisory committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, to the Office of Economic Opportunity. He was very active throughout the state, working on Lyndon Johnson's campaign. And during the period when a literacy test was required in order to be able to vote, he worked on a literacy program in the state of New Hampshire to encourage people to learn to read in order to be able to vote. The three of us actually went to Lyndon Johnson's inauguration. We were invited guests because I was in high school at the time and was also campaigning for Lyndon Johnson. So Barney had a lot of very important things going on in his life. He was a very driven man, but I think that going public with their story really had a negative impact upon Barney. He preferred to focus upon his civil rights activities, his political activities, but now he and Betty had agreed to permitting John G. Fuller to write the book, The Interrupted Journey. The reason they did this is because those newspaper articles by the Boston Reporter were inaccurate. And since the public already knew about their story, they decided that they would go public with the truth about what had happened to them. And they joined in this with Dr. Simon. But it really required a lot from Betty and Barney to promote the book, to travel all over the country, to appear on television and radio programs. And I think that this sort of was very tiring for Barney, given the fact that he was so driven in his civil rights activities. So here we have a man who was working full-time at the post office and was working more than full-time on his other activities as well. and I think that it probably had an impact upon his health. At the same time, there was a genetic predisposition in his family to have a stroke, and he died from a massive cerebral hemorrhage during a blizzard on February 25th, 1969. So, you know, he had had headaches before that. His physicians couldn't find a physiological cause for it. He had been admitted to the emergency room after he had lost the ability to balance and to walk well one time, you know, a couple of months before the cerebral hemorrhage. So something was going on, but unfortunately it wasn't identified by the medical community.
As a child, you were just a teenager when this happened to them. Did you notice for yourself that as people they maybe changed after the episode? Or were they like your same aunt and uncle that they were before?
They changed somewhat. Barney was always a very happy-go-lucky kind of person. He really enjoyed life. He had a very positive outlook. And now we had Barney, who was a confirmed skeptic, I found, who didn't believe in UFOs and felt that if anyone had actually told him that story, he wouldn't have believed them. We had him in this position suddenly ruminating about this period of missing time, about this close encounter, about the fact that he couldn't even protect himself or his wife from this craft that was hovering overhead, from these beings who were in the vehicle, looking down at him, that he felt wanted to capture him. So it really did have an impact upon him. After the hypnosis, and I guess after the book was published, I remember him as being a very positive and energetic person. You know, I said that he was a driven man. So I think that at that point, after having undergone that therapy with Dr. Simon, he did much better. Betty was always Betty. She was a go-getter, you know, a social worker for the state of New Hampshire, child welfare worker, an adoption worker, and a very curious person. She was the driving force behind finding out what had actually happened on the night of September 19th and 20th, 1961. And so she approached it in a much more proactive way than Barney did. And after the book was published, she was very enthusiastic, but she too experienced some health problems. And perhaps those were the result of just putting too much pressure upon herself as a supervisor in the welfare department at that time and as someone who was working nearly full-time in the UFO field, appearing on radio and television programs and speaking at conventions.
Kathleen, you obviously put, I imagine, a lot of time and effort and research into writing the Betty and Barney Hill experience.
Absolutely did.
So, I mean, you know it backwards, but you also serve on the board of directors of the Mutual UFO Network. It seems from what I've read and heard different tales, a lot of people who have claimed to be abducted, it seems to be something that happens more than once. Maybe they are repeatedly abducted. With Betty and Barney, it was just a one-off incident, wasn't it?
You know, that's a difficult question to answer. Betty insisted that she had never been abducted more than once. I have reason to believe that she actually was. I recall one time when I went to her home to visit, and she told me that I would have to take her shopping that day because her nightgown was missing. She said something had happened to her during the night. She couldn't explain it. her nightgown was missing. There was a strange T-shirt on the back of the chair in her bedroom when I went in the morning. She didn't know where it had come from. I think that perhaps she was abducted that night and was wearing her nightgown and was returned in somebody else's T-shirt. I can't prove that, but it was just one of many very strange incidences that occurred that I observed.
I spoke to David Jacobs recently, and he's of the belief that it seems to run in families. So if one family member is being abducted, then more than likely others are. So do you think anyone else in your family, yourself included, has gone through that?
I do believe that other family members have also been abducted. Dr. James Harder, who was the director of research for APRO, the Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization, worked with my entire family. He hypnotized many of us over years. Many people in the family did have close encounters that they had full conscious awareness of. And there is...
Now, when you say close encounters that they had full conscious awareness of, what would some of those have been? Like similar to Betty's, or... Like where they just saw a flying saucer, or were they actually, or a UFO, or where they were actually taken up into something?
These were people who had conscious memories of observing a UFO at close range.
Okay.
In one case, there was an individual in the family who had a recollection of something entering the bedroom during the night. Her husband also had that recollection. When they woke up in the morning, there was mud on their sheets, as if they had been walking outside in the mud. One family member sneezed after having these memories of possibly having an abduction the night before, and this little white object with a, sort of a wire on each end of it flew out of her nose, and she said she quickly threw it into the trash can, and her husband told her to pick it up and flush it down the toilet. So it's a funny thing that no one had any physical evidence to support the idea that they might have been abducted, but there are family members who may have been. We have no evidence that they were.
Right. So in all your research that you currently do and all your involvement with different UFO organizations, are you, in your observation, do you think it's something that is happening more now, less now, or does it sort of go in clusters where you get reports, lots of reports, and then not many, and then lots of reports again?
In terms of sightings, it seems to go in clusters. We seem to have waves. Although every week I receive reports of UFO sightings from all over the world, I don't hear many reports of abductions. And I think that a lot of people are afraid to come forward if they have been abducted. You know, they're afraid of a violation of confidentiality, or perhaps they don't even know who to turn to. So actually in New England now, the local chapter of the Mutual UFO Network is working on setting up an abduction group, or I would say an investigative team consisting of investigators and also of psychiatric social workers and hypnotherapists who will be able to work with abductees, because often they just don't know who to turn to or where to go to. Even if they have physical evidence, we don't hear about it until many years later when the physical evidence is gone. So we're working on that. But it does seem that there are a lot of people who have been abducted, and that this does happen on a regular basis to some people.
When you receive reports of UFO sightings, what would you say the percentage would be of ones that prove to be unexplainable? You know, not obviously weather balloons or, you know, craft that people mistook for something. Is it a large percentage of the reports?
Actually, the largest percentage of reports can be explained as being aircraft or meteorological or just have a mundane sort of explanation. But there is about maybe 10% of those reports where people are actually having close encounters, where the craft has actually hovered above their vehicle and the vehicle has stalled out. Nearly every month I receive reports of people who have actually observed the beings on board these craft, or the craft has landed and the beings are out on the ground. So this is happening worldwide, and it's happening on a fairly regular basis.
And are they always describing similar beings?
Generally, people are seeing the small ones, but occasionally I get a report of very, very tall beings as well, perhaps about 7 feet tall.
Now, there's a couple of schools of thought on the alien thing. I mean, some people, there are the skeptics that dismiss it all as nonsense, and then there's the idea that it can be government crafts that we don't know about, and that the governments are carrying on these abductions for some nefarious reason, and also the idea that they can also perhaps in a sort of collusion with aliens in exchange for technology. Which idea do you think is most accurate in your years of working and researching this?
Well, I always take the point of view of a scientist. I try to remain unbiased. And if I don't have an answer, I study it. I think that it's very interesting and significant, but I don't take a particular point of view in that, because I don't have enough evidence at this point to make that determination.
So what about the idea, okay, so narrowing it down here, what about the idea that the government is in collusion with aliens and that they're allowing these abductions to occur and the experiments to happen? Do you think there's any validity to that?
Well, it's a conspiracy theory. There's a possibility, but I have not myself seen any evidence that convinces me that that's happening.
What about the triangular craft that people are reporting now? Do you think those are from other planets, or is that a government craft?
Perhaps both. In fact, I just this morning received a report from a woman in Florida, in Sebastian, Florida, who saw a triangular craft last night. I had been working with her for several years, and she was in her hot tub, and she looked up in the sky, and this triangular craft with amber lights was flying overhead. And I always asked her to hold her hand out to tell me what she thought the size of this thing would be at arm's length. An aspirin is the size of a full moon. And she said that it was as large as 2 knuckles on her hand. So we can see that this craft was either very, very large or very close or both.
I'm in Florida too, and I heard from someone who does security at night in the building where I work. She said, I think I spoke to her about 3 months ago, and I sort of jokingly said to her, oh, have you seen any UFOs, because she's out all night. So she came bounding up to the car and told me that a couple of months prior, she had seen this big triangular object in the sky, and she got out of her car and stood and looked at it, and she, I think she said it had red lights, and she said it was, it just sat there, it didn't make a sound, and then just quick as anything, it was just gone. And she didn't give too much emphasis to that. I was absolutely intrigued. She was more excited about telling me that when she was, I think, 4 or 5 years old, how her and her sister in the back garden one night saw a circular UFO and how, you know, all this stuff that happened. But so she apparently saw one in Florida, too, a few months ago.
Oh, very interesting. I understand that they are being seen more and more in Florida, and they are silent, and they are triangular-shaped. You know, we have a lot of military bases in the panhandle. I don't know if this is some type of secret experimental aircraft, if somehow we have the ability to fly silently. If we do, I'm not aware of it. So it is all a mystery. It could be extraterrestrial, or it could be our secret aircraft.
Our own government. Yeah. Kathleen, we're coming close to the end here. Is there something you would like to, that we haven't covered, that you would really like to tell us about with regarding the book or any of the latest research that's going on?
Well, yes. People have asked me how I could determine whether that Betty and Barney were credible people. And I wanted to speak about credibility because that is so important when we assess a case. And, you know, the more trained the witness, the higher the level of credibility. If we have an object in a distance, but that's not necessarily the case if we have an object that's hovering 100 feet above a person. Skeptics will tell us that eyewitness observation is completely unreliable. The research that's being done that tells us that eyewitness testimony is unreliable is done by people like Elizabeth Loftus, a false memory researcher, in a laboratory. And the kinds of things that they look at is forensic evidence where they might have a lineup of potential criminals, and they'll ask the victim to identify a criminal from a photograph. And they could have a criminal who looked very, very much like the perpetrator, but is not the perpetrator. And they have found that eyewitnesses can often make mistakes if there is another person who physically resembles the perpetrator. We also know that people can be led by police officers, and we know that people can be led by hypnotherapists at the same time if they're not objective, and that they're offering suggestions. However, we're not talking about which alien out of a group of six abducted a particular person. We're talking about the abduction experience itself. If we have an auto accident, the people who observe this may not remember or may be incorrect about some of the specific details of that accident that occurred. However, they'll know that an accident did occur. So I think that we really have to look objectively at this and have a full understanding. We can't simply explain this away as being poor eyewitness testimony. And that's something very important to me. I think we also have to look at the credibility of the observer. Gordon Cooper, for example, who was the Project Mercury astronaut at Edwards Air Force Base in 1957, was the project manager and a test pilot there. He stated that his crew photographed a strange